This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
For those of you who were with us on the program a month ago, you will recall we did a show highlighting the fact that interest rates have hit the lowest levels in recorded history. You know, if you go back to the founding, say, for example, the Bank of England, that was back in 1694, and they hit a low during a brief period after World War II. Now, that was at about 2.6%. But ever since then, generally, they have been above 3%. We're talking about bonds there, by the way, until the latest period of time. Now we're looking at British bonds below 1%. And it's interesting how, with everything else going on in the world, it's being overlooked that this is something that's truly historic and that these very low historic yields are something new on the face of the planet. And to this date, investors don't seem to fully comprehend exactly what has happened here since 2016.
Yeah, it's really amazing when you look at the cycle that we're in, because historically, bond bull markets last anywhere from 26 to 28 to 30 years. This thing, John, has been in its 35th year. And there were a number of technicians back in the summer of 2012. The 10-year Treasury note got down into the 1.4 range. Here we are on this Friday. It's below 1.4. So this kind of throws out the sort of idea that, you know, we are now beginning a bear market in bonds. Because what we're seeing here is we got used to low interest rates. The Fed brought the Fed funds rate down to a quarter of a point and kept them there for 7 years. And then we spent 2 years coming out of that. It took us almost a year and a half to end taper from the time they announced it in May of 2013 to the time they ended it in November of 2014. And the stock market has been in a quandary ever since. But as many people thought that, you know, from this point forward with the Fed talking about raising interest rates, we were going to see rising interest rates. We began 2015 with the idea the Fed was going to raise interest rates. We spent the entire year talking about interest rates rising. Instead of rising, rates actually ended up lower by the end of the year. Then we get to 2016, start out right out of the gates with the crisis after the Fed raised rates in December. And here we are on this Friday, John, where we have rates now on 10-year treasuries that are lower than where they were in 2012. I really just don't think what has happened in 12 months is something that the markets, the pundits, we thought rates would be heading lower. We never thought that they would be getting this low, because we had a spike in rates, especially in corporates, as we got into the fourth quarter of last year. As the Fed was raising interest rates, it was a great time to be buying corporate bonds because spreads were just blown out. You got junk bond yields that jumped to 8%. They're back down in the 5% range now and below 5. But it was a great time to lock in on interest rates. But my goodness, we keep going from one crisis to the next. We were worried about economic growth. So you saw the ECB launch a very aggressive QE program. We saw that in Japan with negative interest rates in February. And now with Brexit and the problem that's spilling over into the European banking system, when you consider Italian banks have loans in default that are approaching almost 17 or over 17% of their portfolio, in the crisis here in the U.S. with our banks, it never got over 8 or 9%. So all of these global factors are driving rates down even further, and it's really historic what has happened here in the last 12 months.
Why don't you give us maybe a timeline of what has been happening in the last 12 months? Because last year, you remember, corporate rates, they were spiking at that point, and yet here we are. We're a year later, and as we've said again, you know, it's historic lows. How did we jump from there to here?
Well, I mean, just to give you an idea, and I'm going to go down through the whole bond spectrum, because if you are a yield investor, whether you're retired, if you are managing a pension fund, if you are a manager of a bond fund, I mean, you are really having to reach out to get anything that is halfway decent. I mean, we've seen, for example, Ginnie Mae mortgage-backed securities go from several percent down into the 2% range. We're looking at corporate bonds. If you want to look at probably the highest yielding corporate bonds, you would have to go, if we look at financials, a year ago, they were at over almost 3.75%. 3 months ago, they were at 3.3%. Now, they're at a little over 2.9%. If you want to look at industrial bonds, you know, companies like General Electric, a year ago, they were at 4.4%. Today, they're at 3.6%. Utility bonds, which traditionally have been one of the highest yielding areas, not only in terms of bonds, but also in terms of dividend yields. Utility bonds were at 4.8% a year ago, 3 months ago. They were at 3.6%. Now they're below 4.2%. And it's even worse when you look at foreign bonds. Canadian bonds, and they'll probably go lower because the Central Bank of Canada has been cutting interest rates, we're at 1.7, we're at 1.1. Germany, a year ago, and this is really remarkable in terms of what's going on in Europe. A year ago, German 10-year bonds were at 0.75%. Today, they're a negative 13 basis points. In other words, you actually paid the German government money. If we take a look at Japan, a year ago, Japanese interest rates were at 0.5%. 3 months ago, they were a negative 0.1%. Now, they're a negative almost 0.25%. If you want to take a look at the United Kingdom, as you just mentioned, a year ago, British gilts were at 2%, and they're now at less than 1%. And about the only thing that has held up that is anywhere where it was a year ago has actually been preferred stocks. Preferred stocks a year ago were yielding close to 6%, and right now they're yielding 5.9%. So it's probably the only area of the market that has held up and it hasn't dropped.
Okay, now what about tax-free bonds? Because, I mean, there was one point, I remember you talking about them as being an anomaly because the interest on tax-free bonds was actually above that of treasuries.
You know, if you take a look at the tax-exempt market, they're still above treasuries. I mean, if you take a look at a 10-year, about the only thing that is below a treasury right now is a AAA 10-year general obligation bond. The yield has gone from almost 2.4% to 1.34%, which is just a couple basis points below what you could get on a 10-year treasury. But, I mean, if I take a look at the tax-exempt bond index, 20-year bonds, the yield has gone from 3.8 down to 3.18. On 25-year revenue bonds, here we've seen a big jump downward. It went from 4.25%. But a year ago, you could have got 4.25% on a tax-free bond at a time when treasuries were in the 2% range. John, that gap is narrowing. You can still find niches in the tax-free bond market that are above treasuries, but you're going to have to look farther and farther and go out longer in terms of duration, meaning maturity on the bond, than, let's say, what you've had in the past. Even revenue bonds, which traditionally are considered not as safe as a general obligation bond, because a general obligation bond has the full backing and taxing authority of the state. But even revenue bonds, education revenue bonds have gone from over 3% down to 2.1%. If you look at housing bonds, they've gone from 4 to almost 2.5. If you look at hospital bonds, they've gone from over 3 down to 2.25. So, John, everywhere you look, I don't care if you're looking at mortgage-backed securities like Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae, those yields have dropped tremendously. Now, the good news is if you are in the mortgage market and seeking a mortgage, I guess the good news out of all of this, you're going to get 3% mortgages. If you want to get a 15-year mortgage, you can actually get 15-year mortgages at 2.75%. If you want to look at, let's say, adjustable rate mortgages, let's say a 5-year fixed or a 10-year fixed, you're in the 2% range. So if there's any good news out of all of this, it's if you are a borrower, if you are a corporation, you can go out and issue debt today at the lowest interest rate that we have seen in a generation, if not in history. If you are a homeowner, you're going to be able to borrow. And that's why when we talk about the economy, the one segment that is doing very well are home builders in the housing market. And the reason is we've never seen mortgage rates like this. John, I don't know about you, but in my, 35, 40 years as a homeowner, I have never seen mortgage rates this low in my entire life. Some of my clients, one of my clients just recently got a short-term fixed mortgage because they're getting ready to eventually in 5 years, they're going to retire. But John, they got down to almost 2.25%. So these are the kind of rates that we're seeing that truly, I never in my entire lifetime thought we would be talking about interest rates the way we are today.
Okay, let's put this in terms of investment. If you're looking for income, how does all this relate?
Well, let's just say you're Larry Lots Bucks, and let's just make the math easy. And let's assume you have $1 million to invest. Let's say you saved all your life, you have $1 million in your 401k program, you're getting ready to retire, and you have $1 million. Now, when we think of a millionaire, we think, wow, that person's a millionaire. But folks, a millionaire today means nothing. And let me put this in perspective. If you had $1 million to invest today, you put it in a money market fund and kept it there for a year. John, any idea what your income would be for the year?
Well, I'm afraid to ask. What, 0.25%?
Yeah. If you put $1 million in a money market fund at the end of the year, you would get $270 in interest. Now, the good news is, if we were talking about a money market fund last year, you would have got zero. So the Fed raised interest rates 0.25%. Money market fund yields have gotten higher. Now, if you get a little bit more aggressive and you went into a five-year CD, on $1 million, you'd get $12,300. If you were more conservative, if you went into a two-year treasury note, you'd get roughly about $6,300. And today, on this Friday, if you were to go out and buy a 10-year treasury note, you would get less than $13,800. And even worse, you would have to go out 30 years to get anything decent, a 30-year treasury bond, you would get $21,000 in interest.
Okay, that isn't very good. It sounds fairly bad, shall we say, but I get a feeling if we go overseas, picture's probably looking worse, am I right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you think it's bad over here, if you went over to, let's say, I can remember in the year 2000 when we were buying sovereign bonds in Europe and we were getting 5%. Today, if you were to invest in Germany, a 10-year bond, you would lose $1,900 a year on your investment over a 10-year period. You'd lose $19,000. If you invested in Switzerland, you would lose close to $7,000 a year, meaning that if you bought $1 million Swiss government bond, 10 years from now, you would lose $70,000 on your investment. If you go to Japan, you would lose $2,900 annually on a 10-year note. So it is basically, it's not just that yields are historically low. We're entered a world of negative interest rates. And in the next downturn, that may be something we see here in the United States, because it has taken the Fed almost 2.5 years to raise interest rates 0.25%. And that's as far as they got.
Well, that brings us to the next topic here. We'll do a nice transition into the Fed. If you look at the precarious nature of the economic system and even the banking system here, what about their policy? How is this going to factor now?
Well, the Bank of England is expected to meet next week, given the events of Brexit. It is widely expected that the Bank of England will cut interest rates. The ECB is involved in quantitative easing, just like our Fed. That's expected to extend well beyond 2016 and into 2017. The Bank of Japan is involved in quantitative easing and negative interest rates. There's no change coming there. And it's interesting because, you know, like we started at the beginning of the year, coming off that Fed rate hike in December, of course, it was going to be March. And of course, that's been postponed. Then it was going to be June. And of course, that went out the window. And with Brexit, out went the window in terms of July. So looking at the futures market, which has been more accurate than the Fed's own projections, right now, the futures market says there's probably a 12% probability the Fed will raise in September. I personally don't think they're going to do it. I think we can throw that one out. There's just no way a couple months before a presidential election and yelling a Democrat that they're going to raise. So throw September out. We have November, and there is less than a 12% chance in November. And then we get to December, and there's a 26% chance of raising interest rates in December. And I think that could probably go lower. So the futures market is well below the dot plot. So I would say, John, interest rates this year. And even though we got a strong unemployment report on Friday, if you look at the trend and dig deep into the numbers, there is definitely a weakening trend. Now, lower interest rates might have postponed the day of reckoning as rates hit historically low levels, and they keep seem like that trend is in place and will continue. But the futures market is saying the likelihood of a Fed rate hike this year is not realistic. It's probably, if they do anything, it would be next year. And I think next year we'll be doing the same thing that we did in 2015, the same thing that we're doing this year. They may still talk about it, but whether they actually do something is another story.
But you know, Jim, if we project, say, to next year, let's say that things continue to weaken. You know, there are going to be problems in Europe with the banking system, China slowing down. Is it really possible, after all of this hype about rate hikes that we've been following over the last 24 months, we'll actually be talking about a rate cut?
I think eventually that's what's going to happen, because I think low interest rates have probably postponed the talk of a recession, although there was a report out this week by Deutsche Bank, and they're predicting, given what they're seeing with the yield curve, a 60% probability of a recession in the next 12 to 18 months. And I would agree with that. I think it might be a little bit later into 2017, thanks to this drop in interest rates and this rush to global liquidity that central banks are pouring in the system right now, especially trying to keep it liquid. And we've got a flattening yield curve, and, you know, low rates, as I mentioned, probably have extended the recession time frame out a little bit, because obviously lower interest rates have revitalized the market. Central banks are intervening in the market and providing a lot of liquidity as a result of Brexit. That is helping the market. And we've seen some improvement in GDP in this. We'll probably get our first GDP numbers here in the next couple of weeks. And it's expected that economic growth picked up in the second quarter. And if we follow historical patterns, John, we would probably see the height of economic growth for 2016 in the second and third quarter, with another down leg beginning in December. And especially as we get closer to the presidential election, because as you take a look at the economic numbers, automobile sales have peaked at over 18 million. We are now in a downward trend in automobile sales. Business investment peaked, and that is in a downtrend. Profits peaked in the summer of 2014. Profits are in a downtrend, and that obviously impacts business investment and also hiring. And GDP peaked. So we're unlikely to see central banks raising interest rates. And it's not just our view. Some of the great bond investors out there. John, let's play the two clips of Bill Gross there talking about what the Fed is likely to do.
The unemployment rate went up to 4.9, did it not? The wages increased by 0.1 as opposed to 0.2. And so, you know, I think things are not as hunky-dory as 280,000 might suggest, but, you know, back to a normalized 150,000. I think it's nothing to get excited about.
It may not be something to get excited about, but does it get anyone interested in what Janet Yellen and company are going to do? Does this change the calculation of when they might move at all for you?
No, I don't think so. You know, they still have Brexit to look into the eyes, the whites of the Brexit's eyes, I guess. They have problems with Italian banks, or the Fed doesn't, but the ECB and the EU do. The problems with UK property mutual funds. You know, there's a sense of illiquidity in markets, and the Fed, of course, is very obsessed and concerned with markets. The Fed statement last month and the minutes suggested employment uncertainty. And as you smooth things out for 3 months at close to 150,000, I think that does it. I mean, the unemployment rate went up to 4.9, did it not? The wages increased by 0.1 as opposed to 0.2. And so, I think things are not as hunky-dory as 280,000 might suggest.
Of course, there was Bill Gross of Janus Capital in a Bloomberg interview this week.
Yeah, the other thing that we're also starting to see in this economic recovery is credit growth has not been robust as has been in the past. If you take a look at the last decade, you saw credit growth around 9% a year. It's been averaging about 4% in this cycle. And that's one of the reasons why you've seen economic growth be as anemic as it has, in addition to the onerous effects of, let's say, regulation and, of course, taxation. So, John, I don't think we're going to be talking about rate hikes. I just don't see the Fed doing it. If they do, they've got to be leery. And one of the reasons why, economists are saying, okay, maybe September, I just don't see it. You know, they raised rates a quarter of a point in December and then watch what unfolded in the first 6 weeks of the year. So they got to be cognizant of the fact that if we raise rates another quarter point, we don't know what the heck is going to happen to the financial markets. I mean, when they were talking aggressively last fall, we saw credit spreads on corporate bonds blow out. We saw junk bond yields get up to 8%. We saw a dropping stock market week after week. We saw emerging market crisis. We saw a strengthening dollar, which hurt imports. All of this happened from just a quarter of a point. And remember, it took them a whole year to even raise rates a quarter of a point. And I think that's really going to be one of the telling stories of this economic cycle, that typically in years past, for almost 60 years, as the economy began to heat up, as you got further into an economic cycle, inflation rates would pick up, the Fed would start raising interest rates gradually over a period of time. Think of the last decade. In 2004, when Greenspan began to raise interest rates after keeping them low for 3 years, he raised them in quarter point increments and took almost 3 years between him and Bernanke to raise rates. Well, we've spent 2.5 years only to raise rates a quarter of a point. And I think that will be one of the big stories when this economic recovery ends, is that in this cycle, all the Fed was able to do was raise rates one time. And that is a story in itself.
The parties that are impacted by this, Jim, I mean, I'm thinking if you're a homeowner or a company and you need some credit, you can borrow at some pretty reasonable rates right now, let's face it. But the flip side of that, people who rely on various instruments for income, investors, they're in hard straits right now.
Oh, it's not just individual investors. Let's begin with one of the biggest investors in the marketplace today, which are pension funds. I mean, CalPERS came out, the head of CalPERS, which is the California pension system, came out last year. CalPERS is assuming 7 and 8% returns to meet their liabilities to their retirees. It's not going to happen. And the head of CalPERS is saying, we're going to have to raise taxes because we don't have enough money in the pension fund. So pension funds are not meeting their liabilities. Insurance companies are greatly impacted by this as well. And not just pension funds like the state of California, but corporate pension funds. And it's one of the reasons why, John, that over the last three decades, you've seen the responsibility for providing for retirement shift from companies that used to have defined benefit pension plans, shifting the emphasis to the individual with 401k plans. So corporate pension plans are affected, as well as, let's say, city and state pensions, as well as savers. I mean, savers have been decimated by central bank policy because as rates have come down, as they try to protect the banking system, to revitalize the housing market, it helped corporations refinance their debt. It's helped, let's say, homeowners refinance their debt. It's helped borrowers in general, but savers have just been decimated. I don't think people really understand how little money buys today in terms of income, and it's creating what Lawrence Kotlikoff and who I'll be interviewing in the next couple of weeks, as well as let's say, Robert Merton at Harvard, talking about the next crisis in this country is the retirement crisis. Nobody paid a lot of attention to the Social Security Trustees Fund that came out that said basically they're broke. And I interviewed the local head of Social Security here this week, and she's saying by 2035, they're only going to pay 79% of the benefits because the system's broken.
You know, if we can make this strike home a bit, say that I'm an investor and I'm looking forward to retirement and I'm going to need something between $3,000 to $5,000 a month in today's money. What kind of capital am I going to have on top of that to generate that type of income?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at, let's take three very secure type investments, because when people retire, they obviously invest much differently than when they were working, when they could afford, they had a salary they could depend on. So all you have is the assets. So typically people retire, invest conservatively. So what I did is I try to take rates and I try to take a look at where people are putting their money today. So I took a 10-year treasury, I took money market funds and a 5-year CD. If you want $3,000 a month income, which is $36,000 a year, and I think all of you listening to this program would admit, you know, $36,000 a year doesn't put you in Beverly Hills or in Trump Towers in New York. On a CD for $3,000 a month income, you would need $2.9 million. If you were to invest in a 10-year treasury, you would need $2.6 million. And if you were keeping your money in money market funds, you would need $13.3 million. If you want to look at, let's say, $5,000 a month, which would be $60,000 a year, if you were invested in a 5-year CD, you would need $4.9 million. If you were invested in treasuries, a 10-year treasury, that is, you would need $4.4 million. And if you were in a money market fund, you've been sitting in cash during this, following the financial crisis, you would need over $22 million if you were in money market funds. The vast majority of safe investments that are available to you, the individual investor, are less than 1%. If you go long term and you go out 10 years, 30 years, you can get a little over 1%. I mean, you're only getting 1.38 on a 10-year treasury, and you're getting a little over 2%, let's call it 2.1, if you went in a 30-year treasury bond. And the remarkable thing, John, is this is going to continue because, you know, corporations are sitting on $2.5 trillion of cash. Pension funds. Where are you going to put your money? Are you going to put it in banks? Look what's happening to the banking system in Europe, where there's greater talk now that their government's going to have to step in and liquefy a lot of these banks. The Italian government has asked the ECB permission to do that because the Italian banks are in financial trouble. So where are you going to put your money? The biggest game in town and the safest game in town is U.S. Treasuries. Do you want to put your money in the euro right now, given the fact that we could see a breakup? Do you want to put your money in Japan where you actually have negative interest rates? Or you want to put your money in Switzerland where you're going to pay the Swiss government over 0.6% a year? No. So that's what is driving down our treasury market. Every time there's a crisis, Brexit or anything that happens, money just pours into the dollar, pours into treasuries. And if you're in foreign bonds, you're going to get negative interest rates. So this is throwing a lot of people off guard because anytime there is a crisis, and believe me, folks, we'll be heading into another one because we're just in the beginning of this kind of period of time. Imagine what happens when the U.S. economy goes into recession and others, what are they going to do next? Now, that's a subject of another show because I think what you're going to see in the next downturn is helicopter drops, where you see fiscal policy combined with monetary policy. The government will give you a tax cut. The government's going to spend money, and the central bank will simply monetize it and basically print money to pay for it, which means that down the road, even though we're in a disinflationary period right now, we're heading more towards an inflationary period with helicopter drops coming down the future. But what we've seen now is a lot of technicians, we've had them here on the program, thought that the final top of the bond market was reached in the summer of 2012. But all of these crises, the quantitative easing that has gone global, the financial crisis that has now hit Asia, is now hitting Europe, has brought yields down even lower. and, you know, throw technical analysis out the window in terms of what was expected. We're in a downtrend that could see treasuries go below 1%. And if we get into a recession, you could see long-term treasuries go below 1%. So, I mean, in the summer of 2012, we got down into the 1.4% range. With Brexit, we got down to 1.35, and we're now below 1.4%.
If we put all this together, Jim, then I guess you have to ask, is anything working in this kind of market? Or maybe I should do it this way. What is working in this kind of market?
Well, if you take a look at it, since the beginning of the year, the things that are working is an acronym that Jonathan Krinsky, who we talked to in the first hour, calls STUB. That's S-T-U-B. Staples, telecom, utility, and bonds. There's 10 sectors in the S&P. If you take a look at the top performing sectors, telecom, you know, think of Verizon and AT&T, where at one time the yields were over 5%. Telecom is up 19.7% for the year. You have utilities up 19.2% for the year. And you have bond funds like TLT, which is 20-year treasuries, are up 18.3%. Following that, you've got consumer staples that are up over 9%. Now, you compare that, John, to the S&P as of this Friday, which is up 2.6% for the year. The Dow is up 2.7%. High-yield bonds did terribly at the beginning of the year, but they're up roughly about 4.8%. And corporate bonds like LQD, which represents a proxy for corporate bonds, that's up 8.5%. So it's really been the stub trade, just as we have the risk on, risk off. It's really been a risk off trade. So the things that would do well in an economic downturn, your consumer staples, your utilities, your telecom, and bonds are really what has performed well here for investors.
Yeah, and something I did notice, by the way, is that Jonathan Krinsky said that we are not at a top. These things could actually still go higher.
Yeah, I expect that rates can go lower than where they are right now. I mean, you know, when we first did the show on lower interest rates at historical levels never seen before in human history, that was a month ago, John, and yields are much lower today than when we did that show a month ago. I think the stock market can go higher as well because we've got yields dropping. We've got central banks injecting massive, I mean, hundreds of billions of dollars of liquidity into the market. We have an ocean of liquidity being provided by central banks. And we're not done with these problems. We got problems in Europe. We've got problems with European banks. I mean, my goodness, as a result of Brexit, I mean, financials were not doing very well because it was widely expected that the Fed would be raising interest rates. Now, if you're a bank, you want the Fed to raise interest rates because you make a profit. The higher interest rates go, you keep your deposit rates low and you charge a higher rate on the loans that you make. So banks make higher profits. That didn't materialize as a result of the worries and the crisis that we had at the beginning of the year. Rates went actually lower. So financials have not done well. And then, of course, with Brexit, the concern about defaults in the Italian banking system in Greece and other countries within Europe, yields have actually gone lower. So these problems regarding Europe and the EM are not going away. And, you know, the only caution I would say right now, you really need to be careful if you're chasing utility stocks. They're very much at risk because, number one, utilities are heavy capital intensive business. They borrow a lot of money. When rates were falling, it helped utilities because they could refinance their existing debt at lower rates. But if rates at some point they're going to rise, utilities will have to finance at higher rates. And also, utilities, which they're the main cost of running a utility is energy. So falling oil prices, falling natural gas prices, all of that has lowered the operating cost for a utility. Well, since hitting a low in February, we see higher natural gas prices as we get closer to the end of the year. Oil prices have almost virtually doubled. They're in the $45 range, but we see them in the low 50s, maybe upper 50s. As we head closer in the year, and we'll talk about that in the next segment of the show. The other thing is the rise of alternative energy. I mean, you know, John, I live in a neighborhood where almost 60% of the homes, like my own home, is solar powered. So, you know, we're basically off the grid system. Battery technology is increasing. I know we're going to be getting batteries. So home batteries, so that you can harness this power that's created by the sun and use it during the off hours, or, for example, in a power outage, or like we had here in California. We used to get a lot of power outages. And then I'm trying to think of the year 2013, we had a power station that went off on the Arizona-California border in the city of San Diego, went dark for almost 6 or 7 hours, literally the entire city. There was no power anywhere. So, but, you know, you're getting thousands of homeowners increasingly are going off the grid. And I know a lot of the new housing developments that are going up, the new home models include a solar package. So solar energy, what is that doing? It's creating more supply of energy in weak demand. So, you know, folks, if you're chasing utilities because you need yields, unless you're maybe a long-term investor, you have to have dividend yield. Be careful what you're paying, because you're chasing things, and utility PE ratios are probably the most expensive I've seen, John. They're almost in bubble-like territory, as many assets that produce income are.
So if we put all this together and we want to survive the yield crash, where would I be looking?
I still like dividend stocks because the yields are much higher. You also have the possibility that those dividends go up each year. But if I was looking at dividend stocks right now, I would be looking for two factors in my criteria. I would be looking at dividend stocks that have the ability to increase those dividends at 10% or more a year. That's going to limit your universe, because I think the market will now pay attention to not just a lot of the high yielding dividend stocks have been bid up. So what I would be looking at is the maybe lower dividend yield stocks that have a potential for greater increases in those companies that have high return on equity, because that'll tell you how good those dividend increases are going to be. I like short-term corporate bonds. I would not be going long-term with yields down at this level. We still like short-term bonds because you can always roll them over if interest rates begin to rise. That keeps you safe. I like energy stocks. I like the precious metal stocks, especially in this negative interest rate environment. And what I'd be looking for is some of those beaten down sectors of the market. I would be watching financials. I think it's too early for financials, in my opinion, right now. There's still got to be further shakeout. But just like the energy sector was beaten down and the metals sector was beaten down over the last 3 or 4 years, we're seeing that take place in the financials. At some point, it's going to be a good time to get into financials. But, and I'd also keep some cash, because even though we think the markets get ahead higher now with all this liquidity being injected into the market by central banks and the drop in interest rates, I would keep some cash.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Joining us on the show today is Evelyn and James Garris of the Browning World Climate Bulletin, a key source of information describing the relationship between macro weather-related trends and their potential impact on energy, commodities, and the wider global economy.
We have just had a super hot El Nino. I mean, for a short period of time, it was even record-breaking. When they're this strong, then they tend to flip very quickly within a couple of months to a cold La Nina. So you go from one extreme to another with a speed that gives you whiplash. So that's what we are seeing with the global climate this summer, not this year, this summer. And We are going to be doing it in the middle of our agricultural season, and right before we have to stock up on energy because we will be going into a cold winter.
Oil hit a bottom in February at $26 a barrel. I mean, you and your techs have been notably noting that over time. Since then, oil prices have nearly doubled, not quite, and the energy sector is one of the best performing sectors in the S&P, with energy stocks up over 13%. And we're still hearing forecasts for $10 a barrel oil. Is that a yes or a no, or are we going to see rising prices over the long term?
You know, barring some unforeseen tragedy or unexpected event, let's say if the world was to go into another financial recession, very much like what we saw in 2007 and 2009, where we literally saw a global recession. Outside of that, John, I just don't see it. I mean, if you take a look at what we've been seeing lately, U.S. production, we saw the largest monthly decline since the start of the downturn in March. The U.S. was producing roughly about 9.1 million barrels a day, or almost 9.2. April, we got down to 8.9. Most of this, by the way, is taking place onshore. So if you look at the lower 48 states, we're seeing a drop in production in Alaska. We're seeing a drop in production in North Dakota with shale oil. We're seeing a drop in production in Texas. We're also seeing a drop in offshore production. So if you look at it year over year, U.S. production is down about 8% from last year. And the other thing is we've seen production outages, which really turned this oil market around. It began with what was going on in Nigeria, where you have almost 800,000 to 900,000 barrels a day that have been taken offline due to terrorists. And what makes these terrorists a little bit different than the terrorists in the past in that region, these guys don't want to steal the oil and make money. They just want to disrupt the whole oil infrastructure and bring down the government. And so that's a different kind of attitude that we're seeing in Nigeria. You've got problems in Iran. You've got a possible revolution taking place in Venezuela, taking a good portion of Venezuelan oil production offline. And then we saw what happened to the Canadian oil sands, where literally in a month we had over 1.1 million barrels taken offline. So the thing that we forget through all of this is something called decline rates, depletion. You know, you start a well, eventually that well goes into decline and the depletion rates are 3 to 4%. And companies have not been able to arrest those depletion rates because of, you know, what has happened to the price of oil over the last year and a half. They simply aren't investing the money. They've canceled projects. We'll get to that in a moment. But shale production now, John, is dropping by 100,000 barrels per month. And we've had experts on the program. We've talked on this program that year over year, you could see U.S. oil production drop by 1 million barrels a day. And we're sticking with that. And that is basically something that we're really starting to see to come to fruition now, with production dropping by a million barrels. So by December, we could be at 8.6 million barrels a day. The EIA, that's the Energy Information Agency, is on board. In fact, they've gotten a little bit more pessimistic. They're predicting that production could drop by 1.2 million barrels a day by the end of the year.
Okay, but does that mean we're portending here some kind of a series of spikes in oil? Maybe it'll ping 70, 80, maybe back up to 100. Is that really possible?
You know, I don't think so, because during the oil glut period, we have built up substantial amounts of inventory, John, and it's going to take a while to work down that inventory. What I think it's going to do is put a cap on oil prices unless we see something as significant as a drop of a million barrels a day in the Canadian oil sands. Right now, we've got about 3.5 million barrels offline for various reasons. And so I think that inventory is going to keep a cap on oil prices, at least in the next 12 months or so. Maybe after we get past 2017, maybe into 2018, that could be another story, because by 2018, we're going to start seeing a lot more shortages, and we'll get into that because of lack of investment. But the EIA is basically saying by the time we get into next year, the drawdown in inventories could amount to almost 1.5 million barrels a day.
Now that the price is stabilized, then, you remember, shale really hit a rough patch there because of the drop in oil. What about shale ramping up or other such sources that are not in the common run?
Obviously, if we can stabilize at $60 a barrel, you're going to see the shale industry begin to ramp up, but there's always a lag period, which we'll get into here in just a moment. But John, a lot of these investments on new leases, drilling rigs, all of that has been canceled. In fact, it's estimated that $1 trillion of energy investments have been canceled, and that is obviously going to have an impact. And if you're an oil company and you have cut back, you know, you're looking at the price right now, and the oil business isn't like manufacturing. You don't flip a switch on. So oil executives have to be assured that, okay, we think prices have stabilized. We feel pretty good on our forecast of $50 to $60 oil. Then you gradually begin to ramp up again. You start getting your drilling rigs. You might put bids on oil leases, or heck, if I was a big company, I'd be putting bids on oil companies. Much easier to increase your specific company production, but that doesn't do much for overall production. But John, we're going to see all these cancellations of projects start to hit in that 2018 to 2022 period of time, because we have 3 to 4% depletion, plus the fact that if you're an oil company and you're producing oil out the front door, you got to go out and replace it. Well, you haven't made that investment. So all of this is going to catch up with us. And so, you know, we could be in the $50, $60 range, maybe upper 40s, probably for the next 12, 18 months, but a gradual increase on top of that, barring some unforeseen event that nobody can see. But if you take a look at what we're seeing right now, we're seeing production declines in the U.S. We're seeing production declines in Mexico. We're seeing production declines in North Sea. We're seeing production declines in China. And then we have the geopolitical risk that we see in the Middle East, where you have Nigeria. That could get worse. We've got 800,000 barrels down there. We've got, look at the bombing in Iraq over the last couple of weeks. We've got Iraq as a problem. We've got the possibility of a revolution in Venezuela, which is taking, and ever since Chavez took over the oil industry, Venezuela never was able to produce as much oil as when it was run by the private sector. Once the government took it over, production went to hell in a handbasket, and it's getting even worse now. So you've got major producers between those three countries that also could see a further reduction. And then you also have Libya. So, I mean, it's basically the idea that we've been talking here on the program since the beginning of the year, and our experts have been talking about the 1 million drop in U.S. oil production should be come into reality by the time we get to December this year. And as I mentioned earlier, the Energy Information Agency is basically predicting that oil production will go even further. They're predicting that production will be down by 1.2 million barrels, because recently we've been seeing production drop in the 48 states by almost 100,000 barrels a month. That's a lot of oil.
Okay, but since the prices are stabilizing, like I just mentioned, some companies are discussing ramping up. So can't we reverse this decline?
You know, we will start to ramp up. And I think as we start to stabilize, especially when we start getting into the $50, $60 range. But John, there's a lagging effect between the time a well is drilled or from the spud date by nearly 6 months. So let's say that companies ramp up or start to pick up now. You're talking about a 6 month lag time before you see that oil start to hit the market. So, you know, once again, that's why I think we're going to see production continue to drop until we get to the end of the year, when we should be down around 8.6 million barrels from where we are right now. We just hit, in the most recent month, we're down below 9 million barrels, and we've got, what, 4 or 5 months left? Figure 100,000 drop per month. So we should be down to 8.5 or 8.6 by the end of the year. So even if we start to turn around, remember, a lot of companies aren't going to go out and say, hey, let's go for it. It's going to gradually take time before the number of drilling rigs starts to increase the new wells are drilled and that new production comes online. So we could be into late 2017 before you start to see this thing start to stabilize. But even then, John, you're not just talking about bringing production where it is. You remember, companies have postponed, canceled a lot of investments. In fact, they're talking about literally Wood Mackenzie, which is a company that analyzes the oil industry. They're talking about, you know, nearly $1 trillion of canceled investments. So the rig count could take 4 to 6 months to ramp up again. And it may not be to late 2017 or 2018 when we start to get back to levels that we've seen. And if you also look at OPEC, we've seen lower production in OPEC, and then most of that is coming from political risk from Iraq, Nigeria, and Venezuela. And John, I don't see anything in those three countries, at least from the geopolitical reports that I'm reading, that tells me that conditions in that country are going to improve anytime soon. So if you take a look at this, this is a process, just like it took over a year of dropping prices for companies to start slashing their investment, cutting back on rig counts, canceling investments, letting go employees. All of that unfolded over a 15-month period of time or 18-month period of time. It's going to take equally as long to ramp up again. So yeah, we may not be seeing until the end of 2017 before the industry gets back to stable levels where they were prior to, let's say, the downturn that began in late 2014.
So, Jim, if we look over the next, let's take a time frame here, 24 months, which is 2 years, there really won't be any spikes as a result of oil inventories. And there's another factor in here, and that is rising depletion rates. They're running about 3-4% right now. The industry itself can't ramp up because it's really reluctant to do it until it sees stable prices because of the economics involved. And what that means is, okay, we're going to see gradually rising prices, but it's going to take time to ramp up. And you have to keep all of that in a framework.
Yeah. Once again, it does take time. It's a very unique industry. It's very capital intensive. And, you know, it's just like the mining industry. You know, when you do these offshore projects, although there was a story in the Wall Street Journal this week talking about some of the major integrated oil companies, your Exxons, your Chevrons, are starting to ramp up on some of their offshore projects. But John, a lot of these offshore projects are 10-year lead times from the time you bid on a block of water in the Gulf of Mexico someplace. You bid on it, you go through the auction process, you get your drilling rigs out there, you start poking holes in the water, and you know, maybe you strike, and then from the time you get an oil platform out there, you're talking about at least 10 years. So this is going to take time, and it's the same thing with shale oil. If you're an oil company and you're in the shale district, now there are a lot of companies that are still making money on some of their shale wells, but you're not going to ramp up. I mean, you're not going to flip a switch and say you're going to go from, let's say you had at the peak of production, you had 100 rigs that you were running on your project, or 50 or whatever the number is. You're not going to sit there and double that overnight. You're going to gradually increase that little by little. So you might start to see the rig count go up by 2 or 3 rigs a week. Maybe a couple months down the road, you might start seeing it go up by 10 rigs a week. It is going to be a gradual process that's going to take at least a year and a half to ramp up to anywhere near where we used to be. And that's not talking about the geopolitical risks that we have out there. Now, when I said that oil prices are probably going to have somewhat of a cap due to these oil inventories, that does not preclude some kind of spike if there's an event in the Middle East, or you have an environmental accident like you did with the Canadian oil sands. You can see oil prices spike into the high 50s very quickly. But once again, we have enough supply both in oil depositories and plus on ships. So we're going to have to work that off, and that's going to keep a lid on that for quite some time.
Oh, I know what I forgot to mention. Investment implications, because that's where we always want to boil it down to anyway.
As I mentioned, we expect oil prices to strengthen over the next couple of years as supply is destroyed as a result of, once again, depletion. And also, don't forget, a lot of these oil companies, even if things were to ramp up, a lot of them just simply don't have the operating cash flow from their existing wells or the excess capital to reinvest. Now, if the oil stock market does very well, meaning energy companies really start to see their stock prices go up, you might see some of these companies tap the equity markets to raise capital for this project. But this is basically outside of shale, John. If you're taking a look at offshore oil, those projects are long-term in nature. You know, 10 years from the time you discover or bid on a property to the time you bring that oil into production. You take a look at some of these oil platforms in the Gulf of Mexico, they've taken 10 years to bring to fruition. So, as Wood Mackenzie has talked about, $1 trillion of these projects have been basically cut, postponed, some of them indefinitely. So you're looking at probably 5 million barrels of future oil production that has been taken offline. So if you're looking at the energy sector, I think what you want to take a look at, those companies that are geologically and technically strong enough to have grown and protected their production levels in this downturn that we saw between 2015 and 2016, while their competitors had to shrink. So really, you know, this is what happens in an economic downturn. The strong survive. So what you want to do is look at the leaders in the strongest companies in the sector. You also want to take a look at those companies that are financially stable to withstand another year or more at current commodity prices, because right now on this Friday, we're at $45 a barrel. You got to remember, when this all started, oil prices were over $100 a barrel. You also want to take a look at those companies that are levered to the price of oil, meaning as the price of oil goes up, they see a big bang on their buck. So they go from maybe projects that were just marginally profitable in terms of cash flow to those projects that could really benefit. So let's say that, you know, maybe your all-in cost or $30 a barrel, $40 a barrel. Well, if oil goes to $50 a barrel or $60 a barrel, that is all extra profit to the bottom line. And then you also want to take a look at those companies that were managed well during this downturn. And, you know, when you look at an oil company or, you know, for any kind of investment you make, you always want to look at management. How well does management do during economic downturn? Because when the markets are doing well, when we had $100 oil prices, everybody was making money in the business. What you want to take a look at is those companies that could survive and do well in an economic downturn. And once again, you have to take a look at what you're going to have to pay for a company.
If you stipulate all of the companies in the oil sector, are there any ones that look particularly attractive?
You know, depending on your investment risk, some of the integrated oil companies, obviously, they're diverse in their operations. They have upstream, midstream, and downstream operations. They have probably survived the best. You know, there's a couple companies in that area that look pretty good. I think also you can take a look at some of the mid-tiered companies. These are the companies that are really the fast growers. And there's several companies in this area that are growing their production levels at double digits a year. And the market will always pay a premium for those kind of companies, especially when the market turns around. And then also, as investment begins to ramp up again, as, you know, more drilling rigs, oil platforms are taken out, oil service companies will also start to make money again. So those are the areas I like. The areas I'd probably try to avoid are the refiners, because, I mean, you know, refiners made money when the price of energy was going down, because what was their largest cost? Their largest cost was the cost of production, just like it was for utilities. Now that we're reversing, now that we've gone from $26 oil to $45 oil on this Friday, and maybe 50, 55, and 60 over the next 2 years, their costs are going to start to go up. So that means their profit margins are going to slim. So I would avoid them. And I would also probably wait for the drillers, because a lot of these small driller companies, they're going to need to raise capital. They're going to need to get operating cash flow up until they have the means to bid on new projects, to start bringing more drilling rigs online. Probably a little bit too early for those kind of companies. So I'd say right now, what looks good are the integrated large cap companies, the mid-tiered companies, and the oil service companies. These are probably the best out of the whole bunch.
Well, Jim, with the central banks flooding the markets with money and interest rates likely to go even lower, you might think that's not possible. Well, just keep watching. What else should we look at as coming over the horizon towards us?
Well, what do we got coming up? We have the July Fed meeting. I don't think anybody expects anything to come out of that. I mean, the probability of a rate hike is about zero at this point. What we're going to be getting into, John, are some of the economic numbers that are going to be coming out. We're going to get an estimate here for GDP for the second quarter, and we are going to be right in the middle of corporate earnings season. So look for companies coming out, what they're telling us about profits and what they see in the quarters of ahead. So I would say the big thing is the economic numbers and also corporate profits. All that coming up in the weeks ahead. We'll be here to talk about it, as I hope you will. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.